The coronavirus pandemic is exposing how poorly we manage patients with chronic diseases. According to Dr. Scott Lear, a professor of health sciences at SFU, this is because the system relies on the unnecessary requirement of having patients attend hospital clinics for treatment instead of using ubiquitous communications technology. Lear says approximately 12.8 million Canadians have a chronic disease, and more than half of them have two or more. On any given day, hundreds of these patients go to hospitals for clinics, simple physician consultations, and rehabilitation sessions. But he stresses, hospitals are the last place they should be. And this is now being recognized as hospitals across Canada have stopped all clinic visits due to the coronavirus crises. Why, you ask, does the system function this way, especially in a digitally connected world? Lear says our healthcare system is a late adopter. It was designed more than 50 years ago when people were either cured or died in hospital. And he goes on to say that the entire system has hung on to outdated models that include billing. The coronavirus pandemic is a call to action for the Canadian health system. Adversity, he says, brings with it challenge, but also it brings innovation. Lear goes on to say, coming out of this crisis, we are being shown that there are better ways to care for patients with chronic diseases. And once we're over this, we must resist the urge to go back to business as usual. We invited Dr. Scott Lear of the Simon Fraser University's Faculty of Health to join us for a conversation that matters about the potential benefit to our healthcare system that COVID-19 has forced upon it. One where chronic care patients may never have to step into a hospital again.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the following and viewers like you. Please become a patron at conversationsthatmatter.tv.
The COVID-19 crisis is revealing an awful lot of areas of the delivery of healthcare, particularly here in Canada, that now need to be addressed, especially, as you point out in your blog, looking right now at the delivery of healthcare to patients with chronic diseases.
A few weeks ago, in BC and across the country, hospitals were basically discharging all of their outpatients. They're stopping all of the clinics, so people coming for cardiac rehab, diabetes teaching centers, or even seeing a specialist in the hospital for a routine checkup. Those were all canceled. And so the patients were left with nowhere to go, no management strategy. It was the right call, and it is the right call, because you're wanting to avoid these high-risk patients. So when we hear about who's at risk for hospitalization or death as a result of COVID, it's usually people who are older, who have underlying conditions. And these are all the people with chronic diseases that they're getting out of the hospital. So that was the right call. And it also frees up health resources in the hospital to deal with this emergency crisis. But what it did is it made you think, should these patients have even been seen before this in that setting? There are plenty of times that at various different hospitals where there's hospital-acquired infections. So in general, hospitals are a dangerous place for somebody who doesn't need acute treatment because of they're at risk for infection. And as we're seeing, this has kind of pushed us, and a lot of adversity leads to innovation. Many programs were trying to still see how they could care for their and manage their patients remotely. And so that's when we started looking to telehealth solutions as well.
The delivery of telehealth is not new. Why wasn't it being embraced and became the norm a long time ago? What was standing in the way of us embracing that in the past?
Across the world, it doesn't matter whether it's a private or public healthcare system, healthcare is one of the slowest industries to innovate. Mm-hmm. And They're one of the slowest to take in new technology. So in Canada, we're still using the fax machine for healthcare. I don't know any other industry that uses the fax machine, and it's still a vital backbone of the healthcare system. It's how physicians will refer to one another. There are plenty of clusters of physicians that have electronic records, but they're clusters and they don't necessarily communicate with each other. So then the fax becomes that common mode of communication. And so at the same time, there has to be incentives for these telehealth technologies to be used. So many provinces had spent a lot of money on putting in video conferencing networks. British Columbia is no different. Millions, tens of millions of dollars of cost. And this was announced with great fanfare. But there were never any fee codes to support doctors to actually communicate through video with their patients. So the technology was there, just like what we're doing right now. But the physician wasn't going to get paid to consult a patient over video conference. And that was for years. It wasn't like it got fixed 1 or 2 years later. It was in some provinces 5, 7, or more years. So, and then there's just sometimes if there aren't other incentives, there's okay, well, let's just keep doing things as we are. It takes a big effort to go from a paper chart to an electronic chart in terms of taking all that information, and then there's the training involved. And there's also a bit of what I've sensed sometimes culture. There's two things that I think are relevant here. One is that healthcare professionals were trained that the best way to manage a patient is in a physical face-to-face visit. Now, certainly there are some things that require being in that physical space, but less and less. You can do automated blood pressures. We can measure heart rate remotely. There are remote stethoscopes now. And I could see, without some healthcare professionals mentioning it, that switching to this type of mode or a telephone kind of, it's not something they're not used to, but it's almost like it questions their professional identity. No, I need to see this person.
As you're describing this, a couple of years ago, I did a little bit of work with the community paramedicine program that had been set up in remote and rural communities. And I was in one community, and here I am with this community paramedic, and she is monitoring a variety of patients, seniors who are at home with chronic illness. Each morning they go and take their blood pressure and measure this and put their weight on. And all of these were smart devices that immediately fed the information to her. And for the most part, she was able to monitor them from the station. If she recognized an anomaly, that's when she went and saw them. Like, they actually do house calls there. And I kept thinking, well, why can't we do this in the city? Because it must be creating a terrific log jam if these people have to come in to the hospital. And that has been a problem, hasn't it? Like, you have these people who are coming to the hospital and they're taking space because they need to be attended to, but they're filling up the queue.
Oh, definitely. And before this pandemic, there's like on any given day there across Canada, there'd be thousands of these patients going in for visits. Even one hospital, it could be thousands of patients coming in, coming out. And so we can start to visualize this now in today's unfortunate situation, because anytime there's somebody going in to the hospital, there's a risk of transmission, infection. And as I mentioned earlier, there's always been some risk, and sometimes hospitals have norovirus infections and things like that as well. Plus, the other thing is, most of us would like to be, these are stable, they are maybe high risk, but stable individuals, people with heart disease, but they're not having acute problems. It's just managing their care from day to day. And most of them, just like all of us, would rather be treated in our homes and communities. Getting in a car, driving into a downtown urban center, finding parking to go to your half hour visit. Some patients will spend more time each way traveling than they will engaging with any of the healthcare professionals.
Right.
So there are other there's other value in using this remote technology, and it's not just that we need to use remote technology, because we could do face-to-face cardiac rehab programs, but it's questioning, do they need to be in a tertiary care hospital? Could it be in a community center, which we do have plenty of cardiac rehab programs in community centers and YMCA programs. And so that's keeping those individuals out of the hospital as well. But with technology, we can provide access to more. And just as you mentioned, this notion of what we call generating alerts, it's used in a lot of telemonitoring of patients with heart failure, still predominantly through research studies, but different programs around the world have used it, where they'll measure their blood pressure, step on their weigh scale. It's all automated. If something's out of target, as you identified, it sends an alert to the nurse. The nurse can pick up the phone the patient, see what's going on, and maybe even adjust some of the medications, or say, you're probably taking on too many fluids, maybe cut down on your fluid intake for a few days and see how it goes. That type of actual early intervention can also prevent downstream hospital admissions. In terms of left unchecked, that person may start to feel shortness of breath, have trouble sleeping, feel fatigued, and then go to the emergency room. So there are a great many things too that the technology can support. Another thing that comes into play is the privacy security concerns. And these are ones that we need to consider and are appropriate to be concerned about, because if, let's say, if you had electronic medical record, if somebody were able to break into that server, then has access to thousands of patients' records. Nobody's really going to physically break into a hospital and fill their car with paper charts. You carry 12 of them and you get a hernia. So there is that risk, but it can easily be managed and mitigated.
Mm-hmm.
And just like any risk we have as well.
So what is the size of the population or portion of the population in Canada that are dealing with chronic diseases, and how many chronic diseases might an individual have that they need to be constantly visiting for this kind of ongoing care?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's of adults, it's nearly 50%. It's and those are so upwards around 45%, and that's taken into account like heart disease, stroke, asthma, diabetes, cancer, because we're doing so well in acute management of cancer, is now considered chronic disease, kidney failure, arthritis, osteoporosis. So these are all chronic disease, which basically means we don't have the ability to cure them, but we can manage them.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of how people might, there are actually more people with two or more of these conditions than there are with one. So of those 45%, more than half of them have two or more conditions. So there's another way that technology can also help, is right now, so our healthcare system was built and designed like 50, 60, 70 years ago. And we know a lot more now, but if you go into any hospital, you'll see, oh, here's the cardiac ward, here's the kidney ward, here's the respiratory ward. And so the hospital is designed based on organs, but our bodies are all interconnected. But we might be seeing different specialists. Now, family practitioners are great because they have that holistic view. They see the whole patient. And we can also do that more readily with technology supporting us as well.
So with everything else related to the COVID-19 crisis, we're watching industries adapt and be extremely agile in their thinking at speeds that we haven't seen in a long time. Now, you pointed out the fact that the healthcare system is a late adopter of virtually everything. How quickly has this now been pushed up into an area of priority so that the needs of these chronic patients can be met now that they can't go to the hospital?
It's been exponential. It's incredible the speed that's gone. Now, it hasn't, I wouldn't say every program has managed to continue to provide care to the patients. Some programs, their thing was just to, let's just cancel all the appointments and stop having new patients come in, in large part because we don't necessarily know how long this is going to go. Other programs and areas will be coming up with ad hoc solutions, and some that have more experience. So I've worked on a virtual cardiac rehab program with Fraser Health. We implemented it there. Once the funding ran out, it stopped. And that was a year ago. But because of that team now has that experience with doing remote cardiac rehab, they were able to switch over pretty quickly. So they've been running their program at, you know, full speed, but remotely, but they had all that in-house training from when we were all working together and got the other program up and running. So it'll be different for where the baselines were.
So in a number of interviews that I've been doing about leadership in crisis and so on, I've talked to a number of people who say, once you've had a crisis like this, we're not going back to the way that it used to be. And it seems odd to see that we have this moment in the history of healthcare delivery in Canada. Is this, in an odd way, going to help to lead to improvements in the delivery of chronic care to patients? And hopefully, one of the side benefits of that might be that it creates extra capacity within hospitals.
Yeah, so I'm eternally optimistic, and sometimes I'm wrong. But I hope that we don't go back. There will definitely be things that have moved forward. There have been new fee codes in British Columbia to pay for physicians to talk to patients on the telephone, which didn't exist before. So that's not going to be rescinded. That's going to be there. Some of these programs that have made these more established remote virtual variations for managing patients, they'll stick around. I think also, and I also think patients, and now all of us at some time are patients, we also can use our voice. Just like we probably will find that a number of people who started working from home as a result of this will now say to their employer, hey, I could do everything at home and I enjoy it much more than spending 45 minutes driving each way. So can I work from home? Patients will say, well, can't you just phone me like you did before? And right. That is, so I would encourage patients also to use that voice to prevent it from going back. And yeah, it's, there will be some things to get it still to adjust. And there will still be a necessity at times to see patients face-to-face and live, but you're correct. It can free up space in a hospital that for things that are more acutely needed.
So in the last couple of minutes that we have here, I'd like to talk a little bit about your blog, because when you visit your blog, you have taken pretty good look at a wide range of aspects of how the COVID-19 crisis is affecting all of us, whether it's staying at home, our mental health, and so on. Tell me a little bit about the blog, and then also let's tell people where they can find access to your excellent writing.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks. Yes. So people can look at my blog at drscottlier.com. I've been doing this for the last 3 years, and one of the big impetus for me to do this is, as a researcher, my currency is publishing in peer-reviewed medical journals, and the higher profile, the better it is for me. But the work that I'm doing is trying to do things like encourage people to better self-care for themselves, like eat healthy, more physical activity, sleep well, take their medications, and so forth. Those people aren't reading the medical journals, and rightly so. The blog was one way that I thought, okay, I could translate some of what I've learned, my research as well as others' research, into a way to reach a broader audience. And it just, I really enjoy it. I've learned a lot by doing it. And the last, now with this situation, with the COVID situation, I've been looking at, okay, we're going to be staying at home. So like physical activity is near and dear to my heart. So thinking, okay, well, people should still be active because, as you mentioned, the mental health implications, people can be anxious, stress, there's any multitude. Some people are financially concerned, lost their jobs. Others are having now to homeschool their kids while they're working at the same time. And then just the uncertainty adds to that anxiety. Now, but we still have to take care of ourselves. This will be over. And physical activity is a great way to burn off, for lack of a better term, that anxiety that you centered. Similar things to doing like mindfulness meditation. Getting enough sleep is, I think, the foundation for any good day. And healthy nutrition, because it's almost like kind of thinking about the bears coming out of hibernation. We want to come out of our hibernation still physically and mentally well.
Yes. Well, I looked through a couple of the articles and I appreciate the clear, concise manner in which you write. You make it all easily accessible and encouraging. So I say thank you for doing that. Thank you for also coming or taking the time out of your day to do this interview. I know you're busy in the midst of this coronavirus, but you are shining light on some elements that are positive and other ways that we can remain positive. So thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this interview.